yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. They brought Get It Hometown. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is the Alternative Vision Show. Okay, today we're going to turn our attention back to the U.S. We've been talking a lot about global issues here, and we will continue because it is a hot issue, what's going on in China, what's still not resolved in Greece, in Europe, emerging markets collapsing. Okay, currency wars, etc. All right, but we will return back to that. Today, though, we want to move back to issues here relating to the U.S. And by the way, as we go through the fall here, and as the 2016 election campaign picks up, we're going to be talking more about U.S.-related political economy issues as well, including the role of money, which is looming very, very large here in these campaigns. We'll look at Trump. We'll look at Sanders and, of course, the mainstream candidates, which, of course, on the Democratic side will be Hillary. And who knows, on the Republican side, they have such a menagerie of candidates out there. So anyway, we'll be talking more about domestic issues as we go on throughout the remainder of this year, taxes and so forth. But today we want to talk about Social Security. This is the 80th anniversary this past month of the passage of Social Security. And we want to take a look at that very important program, which has delivered so much and is so popular in the U.S., right, left, conservatives, Tea Party, whatever, people recognize that Social Security is perhaps the single most important piece of legislation passed in the last history in the U.S. as far as the interests and standard of living of typical Americans is concerned. Okay. But it's under attack. It's always under attack. Yes, why would anyone want to attack such a successful program? Well, we'll discuss that. And I have a guest here today who's perhaps one of the foremost experts on the whole question of Social Security, Eric Larson. Eric, are you there?
Yes, thanks, Jack.
Okay. Eric, by the way, has written an extremely thorough, comprehensive, excellent book, which I'm going to ask him to simply tell us about. If you really want to know the history of Social Security and the political economy of it and the situation today, you need to read Eric's book. Eric, what's the title of that book?
It's called The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan, and it is from AK Press.
AK Press, okay. And it's online? You can
get it
from AK or you can get it on Amazon?
Sure. Okay. Everything is now available electronically, right? And so is right. The People's Pension.
Okay. And by the way, this book is a great reference book, not just a discussion analysis of where things are and issues and so forth, but it's a great reference. If you really want to start understanding Social Security, go read Eric's book. Eric, let me say a few things before as a lead-in, and then I'm going to throw it open to you and let you go with it where you think the audience needs to know, okay? Well, first of all, Social Security, folks, is an extremely successful program for seniors, the retirees, and those on Medicare. Actually, there are several areas of Social Security categories people should know. One is the more well-known retirement system, where you get a kind of retirement benefit after you've passed a certain age. In the U.S. now, I think that threshold is 66. You got to be 66 years old. You can collect it earlier at 62 at a reduced rate. So it's a retirement system. It's a It's a social pension, you might say. When it was created back in the late 1930s, it was thought of as not a total retirement provision, but part of what was called the three-legged stool at the time. In other words, in the post-World War II period immediately, the whole idea was Social Security would provide about a third of retirement income you needed. Your private pension from your company, called a defined benefit pension, not to be confused with 401ks, by the way, which were created in the 80s under Reagan to destroy defined benefit pensions, which they have largely done. DBPs, defined benefit pensions, were supposed to provide another third of the income you needed in retirement. And then your personal savings was the third of what you would need to retire. So from the very beginning, Social Security was not envisioned as a total social pension, you might say. The problem since the late 1940s is that the other two stools have collapsed. Defined benefit pension plans were usurped by 401k plans, which is really a privatization. 401ks are a privatization of the social benefit pensions and Social Security and defined benefit private employer pensions, designed to undermine and eventually collapse defined benefit pensions, which they have done. That's another issue we'll talk about. And then, of course, personal savings have collapsed as well, particularly in the last decade and a half since 2000, when, you know, wage increases just have not been realized. Wages of median family income, mostly wages, 90% plus of wages of that median family income is wages, have been declining in real terms for over a decade now. So there's no real wage gains going on. There's a whole number of reasons for that. But the lack of real wage gains have meant that people don't have personal savings, or they've reduced their personal savings that they had in order to maintain their standard of living. So the whole idea of personal savings has collapsed as one of the stools, and the defined benefit private employer pension plans have collapsed, leaving only Social Security. And, of course, there's an attack on that as well. So the retirement system is a key component of Social Security, and people kind of know it. But there are other categories in the Social Security system that are important as well. One is called survivor benefits. In other words, if you die, your spouse or your dependent children can collect some of your Social Security. And then there's what's called disability. SSI, that's another element of the Social Security program. That means if you become totally disabled and cannot work, you can collect Social Security before you actually retire. Then in 1965, what was passed was called the Medicare element of Social Security, a big improvement in the 1960s. You know, up to that point, if you were retired, and you had a medical emergency, and of course everybody does as they get older, you became totally impoverished. You lost your house, you lost all your savings, everything to pay the doctor bills to try to survive. People were, before 1965, pretty much condemned to poverty if you didn't have some significant independent wealth. Until, of course, the Medicare plan was passed. Medicare provided two things. One, 100% hospitalization coverage, and secondly, 80% of your doctor-physician bills. Well, the other 20% you had to pay for. And, of course, in recent years, people can buy insurance for the other 20%. Prescription drugs were not covered until 2005, and that became Part D of Medicare. Again, all of this, Part A, B, D of Medicare, is part of Social Security as well. The problem with the Part D provision was that it was really a freebie for the prescription drugs companies, for the pharmaceutical companies. Why? For two reasons. One, there was no tax raised to pay for it. It would come totally out of U.S. budget deficits. And the pharmaceutical companies were given a green light to raise prices without interference whatsoever. In other words, it was a big subsidy pass-through bill benefiting the pharma companies. Some of it trickled down to seniors. Okay, there is some prescription drug benefit there for seniors, but the big part of it really is a subsidy for pharmaceutical companies. By the way, I would just briefly comment that Obama's Affordable Care Act is very much in the tradition of a Part D prescription drug bill passed under Bush in 2005, in that Obamacare is really a pass-through to health insurance companies, who are the big beneficiaries here, and some benefits trickle down to the rest, but it's really a health insurance company subsidy bill, just as Part D is a pharmaceutical company subsidy bill. All right, so that's just a little bit of a background, and we won't say anything more about the Obamacare Affordable Care Act. That's pre-retirees, people who haven't retired yet. But we do want to talk more about Social Security, and both in its retirement and disability insurance elements here and survivors. We can talk about Medicare and its problems and the attack on Medicare as well. But, Eric, I'd like us to focus on the retirement disability survivor elements of Social Security first here. And I'm going to throw it open to you. Let's educate the audience here about where it stands today, the retirement system, and why it's under attack. What are the aspects of that attack, and how can we defend against it and go beyond just defending against it and try to go on the offensive and expand Social Security, which really must happen because, as I said, the other two stools are broken. Pension plans are being phased out and there's no savings. So if retirees are going to be able to survive in retirement, Social Security must be expanded in its retirement benefits. Okay, Eric, jump in here and tell us your view of the current state of the Social Security system.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. I would start by saying that and this continues to be the case today, as it was when I was writing The People's Pension, my book on the history of the Social Security debate, is that Social Security is, in fact, a pretty robust system. Fiscally, it's a system that has paid for itself pretty successfully for 70, now 80 years. It's continually been under attack, as you mentioned, and particularly since the 1970s, when politics in this country began to switch very distinctly to the right. There's been times when the system has come very, very close to being dismantled. That happened in the early 1980s, again in the mid-1990s, and again in the mid-2000s. It seems like every 10 years we have a manufactured Social Security crisis that politicians on the right and the center right, because the crucial participants in this, in a way, are not so much the Republicans, who their opposition to Social Security is taken for granted, but Democrats who are on the conservative side of their party have been very much involved in attempts to dismantle it. Now, I would start by saying that the best way to look at Social Security, if you're concerned about its health and you're concerned about whether it's going to be there for you, the place to start really is to look at the overall economy and Social Security's place in it. Social Security currently costs the equivalent of about 4.5% of the United States economy every year. It In other words, the amount that's spent on Social Security benefits is equivalent to about 4.5% of the entire economic output of the United States. That's a pretty modest amount of money.
None of that comes from taxes, does it? I mean, that's important. None of that comes from your income taxes or your sales taxes or property taxes.
Not at all. It comes from payroll tax, which also funds Medicare, or a portion of Medicare, that is. So Social Security really is a program which pays for itself. That's why it's called a social insurance program, because the people who participate in the system and will ultimately collect benefits from it essentially fund it through a direct dedicated tax that goes into a trust fund that's used to pay benefits. Now, as I said, about 4.5% of GDP every year is accounted for by Social Security. It's a pretty modest amount to pay for an absolutely crucial system that is increasingly central to retirees, to survivors, and to the disabled in this country. As Jack mentioned earlier, the other elements of the three-legged stool of retirement savings, if you will, have collapsed or have essentially been dismantled in recent years. Private savings has become more and more impossible for a lot of people because of wage stagnation. Traditional defined benefit guaranteed pensions from employers are disappearing. They're disappearing rapidly in the private sector, and they're beginning to come under serious threat in the public sector as well. Now, if you were going to take Social Security and make it whole, in other words, let's look at what it would cost to fund Social Security out over the next 75 years. What portion of GDP would be going to fund Social Security then? Well, the answer is about 6%, a little over 6%. Which, again, is a very modest amount of money to be paying for such a crucial program. The point I'm making, in brief, is that in an economic sense, Social Security is a very sound and very affordable system for this country. It is not something that's spending us into bankruptcy. We don't have to worry about the elderly eating all the seed corn that the young need to build a strong economy in the future. That is not the case, and it's largely propaganda and manipulation of numbers.
Now, is that 6%, Eric, is that 6% representing Medicare and the retirement part of Social Security, both, or just the retirement?
That's just the retirement part.
Okay.
Medicare is on top of that, and Medicare could, and I want to underscore that, could become a more costly part of the economy in future years. But that depends on one thing. It depends on whether we're spending our money, our health care money, intelligently. And we have a system now, even Medicare is essentially built on a system of private providers. And there are huge hidden subsidies that they receive, as you've mentioned. And that's really the core of the problem. To the extent that we have a problem taking care of the elderly in later years, it's very much bound up with the larger problem of health care costs, which is something that Obamacare really has not solved. To the extent that we have a problem, it's a health care problem, which we need to see to. Social Security itself, which is intended to cover the non-health care expenses or a portion of the non-health care expenses of the elderly, is not in any kind of trouble in a real sense.
Hasn't it been generating a huge trillion-dollar surplus for the last several decades?
It has been. And one reason for that was the 1983 amendments to the Social Security Act, which essentially boosted taxes faster than they needed to be boosted and raised the retirement age from 65 gradually up to 67, which is a controversial move at the time, not entirely necessary. And it was done to essentially to placate the Republican right at a time when Social Security really did need to have its finances shored up. So there's an argument to be made that we've been paying quite a bit more for Social Security even than we really need to for the past 30 years.
Well, that's kind of an argument that, hey, folks, there's no question here about it not going broke. I mean, if we have the surplus there, even with the baby boomers retiring, the retirement system, in other words, the basic retirement system, is well funded for decades to come.
Exactly, exactly. And this is important because there's an awareness of this in this country, I think, that's growing, that there is a retirement crisis looming. That retirement crisis doesn't have to do with Social Security. It has to do with the fact that private pensions are disappearing and it's becoming harder for people to save for retirement. Just to give you a dramatic example of how that's the case, Social Security itself, the benefits that you get are based to some extent on the amount of money that you earn during your career. The formula is based in part on the average compensation you get, the average wage you draw over the course of your career. Wage stagnation has reduced not only the funding of Social Security, but the amount of benefits that people get. It's been calculated that something like a third to 40% of the shortfall in the Social Security Trust Fund over the next 75 years is due to wage stagnation. If people had been earning money the way they should have been or had been in the 60s and the early 70s during the rest of this time, Social Security's trust fund would be a lot larger, a lot healthier, and we wouldn't be hearing the kind of arguments we're hearing, or at least not quite as much of it, about the need to fix Social Security or reduce it or rationalize it or dismantle it. So wage stagnation has had a profound effect on Social Security itself.
Talk a little bit about this question of the tax cap. This payroll tax, of course, is only collectible up to $118,000 and change of earned income, in other words, wage and salary income. Capital incomes, in other words, from interest and capital gains and so forth, isn't taxed at all to fund Social Security. But, you know, there's a cap here, isn't there, $118,000. So folks who are making salaries above $118,000, and that's increasingly, significant group of high-end professionals and so forth, they only pay tax for Social Security up to $118,000, then they don't pay anything over and above that. What if that tax was applied to all earned incomes, forget capital incomes, all earned incomes, not left at a cap of $118,000, how much more could Social Security revenue be increased and therefore used not only to solve whatever problems people are saying exist, but actually expand it?
Well, you're absolutely right to bring this up. I should mention that cap is adjusted every year. A few years ago, it was at $112,000. It's up now. But that doesn't really keep pace with the growth in the high-end incomes in this country. The reality is that as wealthy people collect more of their income through capital gains and investments on their investments than on wages, the amount of actual compensation in this country that's taxed for Social Security shrinks. And so we're literally not taxing people as much for Social Security now as we were 30 years ago. When I say people, I mean the affluent. It used to be in the early 80s that something like 92% of all wages and compensation in this country was subject to Social Security tax. That's down to about a little over 80% now. And that, again, makes a huge difference in terms of funding Social Security in the short run. Now, if we were to raise that cap, if we were to eliminate it, we could eliminate between 40% and 50% of the long-term deficit in the Social Security Trust Fund. It would have that big an impact. And if you combine that with if we were to have labor policies in this country that actually encouraged growth in wages, we'd have most of this particular long-term projected problem dealt with right just like that. Now, personally, I have to say that I'm actually not in favor of completely eliminating the cap on the percentage of income that's taxed for Social Security. And the reason is that if you raised it and you eliminated the cap completely, that would mean that benefits, Social Security benefits, would be based on 100% of income as far as the eye could see. In other words, somebody, Bill Gates, for example, who makes in the seven figures every year, if not more, would be getting Social Security benefits when he turns 67 based on a multi-million dollar income every year, and we wouldn't want to see that. Social Security is supposed to be a base benefit, and so it's not meant to give somebody a benefit dollar for every dollar they earn. It's supposed to give you a benefit up to a certain level of income. I think that level of income needs to be sharply raised. The idea that
where do you think that raise level should be? 200,000 or what?
I would say even a little bit higher than that. I'd say maybe 250,000. There's a lot of places in this country, including Manhattan and New York City, where, believe it or not, that's considered to be a middle class income based on the cost of living. And there are a lot of people who earn that amount of money. They should be paying a lot more towards their Social Security benefits.
And is that $250,000 sort of a threshold where the super rich wouldn't be getting more than they're paying in? That problem you referenced here before, is that like a cutoff where more money would be raised for the trust fund than would be paid out to the rich if it were a simple total percentage?
No, I base that really more on what amount of money would you have to tax in order to give people who are at that level of income a size of benefit that makes sense, that's equitable. In other words, you'd want them to be. It's perfectly all right if somebody in that income level, who's accustomed to that income level as a working person, is getting, let's say, $40,000 per year from Social Security. You wouldn't want them to be getting $100,000 or even $60,000. So
right.
I don't base it so much on what would eliminate more of the long-term shortfall for Social Security, but what would be an equitable amount of money for them to be getting as a benefit.
How do we get to this idea of a long-term, how long is long in this case, shortfall when there's trillions of dollars in the Social Security Retirement Trust Fund?
I'm glad you asked that, because that was really the question in a way that got me thinking about Social Security and writing about it, because where it comes from is projections that the Social Security trustees make every year about the long-term health of the system. In the mid-60s, they began making projections out 75 years. In other words, if population increases, if the birth rate increases, if life expectancy increases at roughly the same rate that they are now, if wages increase at roughly the same rate they are now, how much money will be going into the Social Security Trust Fund? How much money will be collected every year going out to 75 years? And at that point, will we be bringing in enough money to the system to pay for it? Now, 75 years is a very long time, and it occurred to me that there is something rather unrealistic about that. You wouldn't want to make a determination about what to do. You wouldn't want to make drastic changes in a program like Social Security based on where it's going to be in 75 years, because we don't really know. If you ask the trustees and the actuaries of the Social Security Administration, they'll say, we have to make projections like this so we have some idea of where we're going. Well, that's fine, but I think it's irresponsible of politicians on the right and the center right in this country to take those numbers and treat them as though they're carved in stone and to say, all right, we have a problem, we have a crisis today because we think there will be a problem in 75 years. My own view of it is, if you see a deficit in 75 years, probably the best thing to do is to work on policies which would promote higher wages, which would promote better education, which in turn promotes higher wages, and that brings more money into the system so that you can pay for it. That makes more sense to me than cutting the program, continuing to have policies in this country that are anti-worker and that essentially create a kind of a race to the bottom, where you have a less affluent workforce increasingly unable to support itself or support itself in retirement, either way. It seems to me that the whole debate over the period of time that Social Security has been under attack has been kind of a cart before the horse problem that assumes a crisis where there doesn't really need to be one.
Yeah, one of the problems with that far out a projection, 75 years or even 20, 30 years, is that a small change, a very, very small change in one of the assumptions, be it average age of living or wage increases or whatever, a very, very infinitesimal change in the immediate situation produces a huge change way out there. You know, 20, 30, 75 years, it's almost impossible. So those who play games with trying to argue that Social Security is in trouble, you know, take a small shift that may be due to a business cycle or something now, and then they just extrapolate it for decades, and, of course, you get this huge loss and shortfall. Forecasting anything beyond 10 years is just nonsense anyway. But,
yeah, Lyndon Johnson once said that when Medicare was being considered in the mid-60s, Lyndon Johnson said, don't let anybody make any projections further than 2 years or we're never going to get this thing passed. Those kinds of projections and treating them like they're set in stone is an invitation to never do anything for people in need in this country, to never do anything for the collective benefit of working people. That's what happens, and that's the problem with these kinds of numbers when they get turned into sort of totemistic items that you have to sort of bow down to. But you know, Jack, you mentioned that there's a sort of a game playing with numbers that go on, and you're absolutely right. A fraction of a percentage point in interest rate projections can create huge shortfalls, or it can eliminate them. But you know, these games are very serious to people. AARP did a poll recently where they talked to younger Americans about Social Security. 85% of the people they talked to, these are younger people, these are not older workers or retirees, but younger people, said that it is very important for them for Social Security to be there when they retire. 85%. There's a big understanding among working people in this country how crucial this program is, and which makes it really kind of outrageous when these kinds of games are played with numbers in Washington.
Yeah, and
because the need is so great.
Argument typically by those who are opposed to Social Security is that it pays too much, but yet you look at the average annual benefit, monthly benefit that people receive, the average annual or monthly in this case benefit, well, the annual is about $16,000 a year, which is about $1,300 a month. How do people even survive on $1,300 a month? I mean, if they didn't have the $1,300 a month, and of course food stamps now that many of seniors have to rely on, then they would be picking garbage and out of trash cans and so forth. But, that's not overly generous, $1,300 a month.
No, it's not overly generous.
In some urban area, I mean, that's a poverty wage. It really is. And, you know, we talk here about lack of personal savings and private defined benefit plans disappearing. 38 million households, not people, but households. There's about, 115 million households in the U.S.?
Yep.
38 million have no savings whatsoever anymore. In other words, one-third of Americans have no third stool, no savings. And, of course, how many have a true defined benefit pension plans anymore? Not very many. They've been disappearing as 401k plans have taken over. And the 401k plans, you know, what, $18,000 is the average amount in a 401k plan? Plus, you can lose it all. You know, we saw that pension plans during the crisis lost $4 trillion. And seniors aren't earning any interest from fixed income investments now for 6 years since interest rates have been down to zero. Of course, the bankers and investors are making hand over fist because it's zero borrowing. But mom and pop retirees are making nothing. So everything seems to be stacked against retirement in this country and getting worse. And the only last bulwark is this very modest $1,300 a month benefit called Social Security, and yet they're still attacking it.
The reality, if you want to know how do people make up the difference between that $1,300 a month and what they need to survive, the answer, unfortunately and very disturbingly, is families. You have people, elderly people, who are having to move in with their children. You have young people who are having to not making any money, having to move in with aged relatives. You have a system that is beginning to collapse, and people are beginning to households and families are bailing water. There is a great deal of strain being placed on people in their prime earning years who are raising children and taking care of aged relatives at the same time, the so-called sandwich generation. The retirement crisis is having is already beginning to have a really, really profound social impact in this country. The point being that households that are already under a lot of pressure in the labor market are having to take on this extra burden of taking care of retirees, disabled relatives, et cetera, because the benefits that Social Security provides them are diminished. In the early 80s, Social Security could make up as much as 42% of a person's average earnings as working people. Today, it's down to the low 30s. So that benefit does not cover as much as it used to. And the problem is essentially that what's been a collective benefit is essentially being offloaded onto households. Whether or not they have 401ks, they're being required to do the work. And that's the part that's really ominous to me.
Yeah, and we have the same sort of drift in terms of the real minimum wage, declining what it actually pays. And, of course, we have wage theft going on, and we have no gains in nominal wages for those who are working. So no wonder the economy can't get going, you know? I mean, wages aren't growing, and, they may be hiring people, but they're part-time temp contingent work or low-paid or people working for nothing, you know, young students going on, doing internships, working for nothing. And they think because they had some part-time temp jobs that, here comes the economy. Well, the economy's not coming because there's no wage growth there. And as you said, if there's no wage growth, that's maybe the number one thing that creates the stress on Social Security in the future down the road.
Yeah, the really disturbing thing is the extent to which in the fantasy world that our lawmakers live in Washington, D.C., very little of this is really understood. In the aftermath of the financial crash in 2007-2008, Social Security was actually a bulwark of the economy because it was allowing the elderly people on Social Security to continue to spend. It propped up the consumer economy at a time when, for a lot of people, consumer spending was grinding to a halt. And so it helped to buoy up the economy. That's one of the social economic benefits of a program like Social Security. And yet at that time, there was fierce discussion of the need to cut entitlements. Obama created an entitlement commission in 2010 that recommended changes in Social Security that would essentially phase it out, that would whittle it away over the next few decades to the point where it would not provide a consequential benefit to anyone. And this was being considered right at the time when Social Security was proving to be an absolutely vital part of keeping the economy going. It boggles the mind to think that Washington could have been thinking along those lines at such a time.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole trend among the politicians, both wings of the corporate party of America, as I call it, has been to privatize these collective benefits, and they've been doing and chipping away at that for years now. I mean, they've privatized what was a collective pension system, defined benefit pensions, turn it over to individual 401ks. They've privatized and are continuing to privatize the collective negotiated healthcare, employer-provided health insurance system, and Obamacare is, you know, the latest expression of that. Union-negotiated health plans are going to collapse in a couple of years as the 40% tax on these plans takes effect. It was designed that way. Bush instituted health savings accounts, you know, and that was privatization. And it's not surprising that these proposals to privatize Social Security are also rampant. And, you know, we already have the camel's nose under the tent here with on the Medicare side in terms of privatization. So, you know, that's the whole trend to take back the social wage. You know, whether that social wage or deferred wage is your pension or Social Security or whatever, the whole plan, the politicians and you know, the wealthy in this country is to privatize and take back those wages that were paid into these funds. I mean, they succeeded so well in taking back nominal wages, reducing nominal wages through a whole number of ways. Now they're going after the social wage. Then they wonder why they can't get consumption going. Well, we can always borrow more, right? That's how we finance our standard of living now. We don't get enough income to pay for goods, but you know, we can borrow more money, which means they're going to take more of our wages in the future. So there's this big whole system of how they're going to take back wages. How are they going to take back wages in these very different various forms? And this attack, I would say, on Social Security, that's always there, below the surface, as you say, going on for years and decades, is just another expression of a social wage cut strategy.
Yeah, I would say, just for perspective, that the part of what's remarkable about the story of Social Security over the last 30, 40 years, and it's one of the reasons that I wanted to write my book on the history of the Social Security debate, is that Social Security has been the one part of the New Deal legacy, or the social insurance system in this country, that they haven't been able to privatize. And that's partly a tribute to the way it was set up by FDR and his advisors. There's something very politically very astute about Social Security. It's the one, along with Medicare, it's the one part of the social safety net in this country that is funded by a dedicated tax, and it's set up in the form of a social insurance system, which means that people have a sense that they earned it. We paid into it. It's ours. We earned it. This benefit is not something that's being given to us. It's something that belongs to us. Mm-hmm. And that sense of possession, of collective possession, is a very powerful thing. And it really is a big part of what's kept Social Security from being dismantled up to now. The flip side of that is that Social Security hasn't been improved in a major way in 40 years now. That's 40 years of a profoundly changing economy, changes in lifestyles, in patterns of households. Social Security, in many ways, is still really built around a model of the male breadwinner in the nuclear family with the two kids and the wife and so forth. It needs to be updated considerably. in light of the way society has changed in the last 40 years. And one of the more encouraging things I see is the at least the progressive wing of the Democrats is starting to agitate to expand and enrich and improve Social Security, not just to raise the cap, but to use that as a vehicle for improving benefits.
Well, can you explain that? Go in a little more in more detail. What's happening in Congress here in along those lines? I know, as a prelude to that, I know that there are anti-bills in Congress that are trying to make a trade-off between retirement benefits and disability benefits, right? I know that negative. In other words, there are proposals by Republicans and conservatives that say, well, okay, if you want to continue paying disability benefits, which are rising because of the recent recession and slow economy and people going on disability because unemployment insurance doesn't pay much, that's true. Disability claims are rising. But what they're saying is, okay, if you want to continue funding disability, then you got to take it from other retirees. And there was a quid pro quo thing here, which is a very negative, dangerous thing. But as a prelude, what are the more progressive proposals that are pending there or being suggested to expand Social Security?
Yeah, I can give you there's a number of bills on the Democratic side. Representative Raul Grijalva's bill is one that's got especially quite a few good things in it. And you're right to point out, first of all, that disability insurance has become kind of the flavor of the month for people on the right who want to attack Social Security without attacking the old age part of the program, which, of course, is the most popular. The bills that I see that have a lot to recommend them are doing a number of things, among others, increasing benefits across the board modestly for everyone, increasing benefits for caregivers, for people who have to leave the workforce for a period of years to care for children or for aging relatives, provide credits for them so that they don't go through a period where they're not earning any benefits from the system. There's increased benefits for spouses and even divorced spouses. That's something else that we need. Then there's also provisions that are being considered or at least that have been proposed or tabled in Congress to increase benefits for people at the lowest end of the wage scale. Increasingly, we have many people in this country who spend almost their entire careers working for more or less minimum wage, and they should get a bump up or a better benefit from Social Security because they're the ones who need it most. Social Security is an income redistributive program, and it needs to work better that way. And so the idea is to make the system of taxation that pays for Social Security more fair, and to do that by raising the cap, and then to use the leg up that gives us to increase benefits, particularly for people at the low end of the wage scale, but to some extent anyway for everyone, because this reflects an understanding that it's not just people at the lower end of the scale who are going to be faced with a retirement crisis. It's going to be people in the middle who consider themselves middle to upper middle class, because what if their 401ks don't have enough money in them to support them in retirement along with Social Security? So there's a range of things, but they all involve raising the benefit to some extent. What I would like to see is to return the retirement age to 65. There's no reason, in my view, that it has to be raised to 67 or 68 or even 70, which is what some people on the right are proposing. There's an awful lot of people in today's economy who are not able to work beyond that point, beyond age 65 or even younger age. Physically demanding jobs, the nature of them has changed to some extent, but they still exist. And I think it would be a very progressive move to reverse that increase in the retirement age that was legislated back during the Reagan days.
What
there's a number of things here, yeah.
In terms of benefit, that's very interesting. What else are your own proposals here?
Well, that's one of the things that I think is really important. I think that to really do this right, we need to look beyond Social Security. We need to think about how to create a system that that does not depend on a retirement system that does not depend on 401k investments, because 401ks aren't savings; they're investments. They're risky investments that are made over a period of time in stocks and bonds and so forth. That's a very difficult needle to thread for a working family. The retirement system should not be based on employer benefits. I think that the private pension system in this country was really developed during the Second World War as a way to defer compensation for workers into a retirement program. This was at a time when companies like General Motors were expected to sort of go on forever being behemoths that employed more and more people. That's not the kind of economy we have today, and I don't think we should expect to go back to that. As a result, we need a system that is not tied as closely to employers as it has been for the last 70, 80 years. And that means that we should, I think, turn Social Security into something a little different than it is today. It should provide benefits the way it does. It can even collect taxes the way it does. But I think there's an argument to be made for turning Social Security into, at least partially, into a vehicle that invests in the things that are needed to support the elderly, elder housing, health care, other services that the elderly need, so that we can take that money and turn it into a collective system for caring for or for providing for the aged. There were arguments that were made on that along those lines in the early days of Social Security, including by Arthur Altmaier, who was the first commissioner of Social Security. They were quashed by Republicans who saw that as quote-unquote pension fund socialism. But I think we need to consider whether Social Security shouldn't be aimed much more directly at providing the things that the elderly actually need, and making sure that those things are provided in an equitable way. There's tons of housing being built for the elderly these days, but it's all for the upper income elderly. Super retirement communities for the elderly being built all over the country. But whether the people who are at the low end of the income scale who might really need something like that will be able to afford it is another question. That's something that maybe Social Security needs to be more directly involved in. And then we can take a stab at actually correcting some of the inequities among the elderly. It's not fair that some people should be able to retire in lavish circumstances, and some people should barely be able to eke it out living in a spare room with their kids. We need a system that can create a more equitable set of options for the elderly. And so I think that's where we need to think in as far as a broader vision for this system.
I think what you're talking about is a kind of a government direct investment fund that would take the surplus from the overpayments that exist in Social Security and invest them and use the proceeds from that and those investments to help expand the fund itself. That's I made something of a similar suggestion a few years ago when I wrote a small book called An Alternative Program for Economic Recovery in response to what was going on in the Obama administration in 2009 and 10. What I had suggested was something that you're talking about here. Expand that fund, to jumpstart that fund immediately, I also suggested that all the 401k money in the country be put into that fund. In other words, you consolidate the 401k private pensions, and you consolidate that with the Social Security Trust Fund. You make some other adjustments on unearned income contributions to this, maybe even a business-to-business value-added tax, and you create this huge government direct investment fund that could then accelerate alternative energy investments and other social investments, so forth. I gave exact figures how this fund could actually work very successfully, and you would be able to significantly increase Social Security benefits and provide Medicare for all. In other words, not just for those over 65, which is another issue that has to happen because what we've got now at Obamacare is not a solution to cost controls or to the crisis in the healthcare system, not just the retirement system. Both of which are overlap here with the elderly. But the problem with that, Eric, is that, your corporations and investors will fight that tooth and nail, because what that means is government becomes an investment competitor with the private sector. And they do not want government involved in competing with them for investment projects. And they will see that as a system game changer, and will resist it tooth and claw here. But that is what has to happen on the social end if we are to do anything about preventing, as you say, this retirement crisis that's coming, and the healthcare crisis that is closely associated with it. We have a breakdown going on in this country of both the retirement system, which was set up in the late 40s, as you've sort of referred to indirectly, and the healthcare system, which began breaking down in the 1990s as well. And the only way to solve that, the private sector, the market, is not going to solve these two crises that affect tens of millions of people. The only way to do that is through government investment. But you have to create new vehicles to do that. And I agree with you, your suggestion about this government investment fund, but I would say it has to be even expanded even beyond just focusing on Social Security. It has to be a fund that provides a solution to the general retirement problem. For listeners who are interested in that, you can go to my website, Kikos Productions, and you can order this pamphlet for a couple bucks, in which I made those proposals and how to finance that and other proposals as well. What do you think here about this the suggestion that we see from time to time that you can really boost the funding if you also tax non-earned incomes, in other words, capital incomes, interest income, capital gains, so on and so forth, or impose a business value-added tax to help fund these projects?
Well, you put your finger on it.
What's your view on that? Do you see that as part of a solution, or is taxing capital incomes Not a solution?
Well, there's a couple ways to look at this, and you put your finger on a major problem, which is that over the last few decades, affluent people in this country, more and more of their
income. Looks like we're getting a signal here, Eric. Gee, this hour went so darn fast, and the station's saying we're running out of time. Can you give me a 30-second answer to that question?
Of course, capital incomes? There's a couple ways to deal with this. You can either tax capital income and so forth, the investment, which is basically the investment earnings of the wealthy, or you can change the tax system such that that more of the money that the wealthy earn, they'll be motivated to earn through wages, and then we can tax them through wages, and we can have the same effect. Either way,
I think we're going to have to leave, Eric. I'm sure we're going to have you back here, because we're going to see in this election year some more proposals on both left and right here in Congress on attacking and solutions to Social Security. So Thanks very much for coming on, and we will be talking next week again about domestic issues. Join us.